Thanks so much for the organizers for inviting me and allowing me to speak in my native language, which isn't even English, but a strange dialogue called American. I think I'm not really après Darwin, although this session is après Darwin, I will be more apropos Darwin. And I wanted to speak to the general theme of the conference, which is the history of disciplines. There's a long tradition of Darwin reception studies in various disciplines, but the theme of the conference allows us to raise new questions. What kind of knowledge was Darwinian science? How did Darwin's work impact upon the very structure of disciplines? And how was this structure constructed in different settings and transformed over the course of the 19th century and beyond? And I've titled my talk, Reading Darwin Across the Disciplines, because I think it's useful to consider Darwin not just a transformist a la Lamarck, but as a naturalist a la Buffon, an author of books that spanned geology, zoology, botany, as well as emerging fields of anthropology, psychology, and biology. You have to take that. So a naturalist whose methods and tools were not discipline specific and whose readership was broad and socially diverse. And this Buffonian style of natural history, of course, had a difficult and contested place in France after the Revolution and the institutional reforms that favored highly specialized technical forms of knowledge, creating the disciplinary norms by which Darwin was later evaluated. And there's an exchange of letters between Darwin and Armand de Quatrefages that hints at how he was read, this English naturalist, how he was read across the channel. As some of you may know, Quatrefages, though a critic of natural selection, led the campaign to elect Darwin as a corresponding member of the Académie des Sciences, nominating him 5 times in the anatomy and zoology sections and failing pretty miserably each year until he was finally accepted by the botanists in 1878. So he prepares his case in 1870 and he writes to Darwin for help. Be so good as to tell me whether you have published this volume on the geology of South America that was supposed to be part of the Beagle expedition. I've looked for it in vain in our library and at the museum. It's very important for me to know whether it has appeared. It's being said at the Academy with a view to harming your candidature that you had done no more than collected natural history specimens and that you had called on assistants to describe them. I'm bent on showing the part you had in the publication. Tell me, if you please, what the format is, how many pages there are, and maps. So Quatrefages is referring here to 3 books that Darwin published on geology after the Beagle Voyage, containing his most ambitious empirical and theoretical work on the formation of coral reefs, the connection between continental uplift, mountain chains, earthquakes, and volcanic activity. And he also alludes to a five-volume zoology of the Beagle that Darwin edited based on the many thousand specimens that he collected on the voyage. The opposition to Darwin's candidature in 1870 was led by the zoologist Émile Blanchard. From a brief report, we know that he spoke for over an hour describing Darwin as a mere collector who was incapable of making a scientific study of his collections, whose work on pigeons was also unscientific, and whose theory of descent was both false and unoriginal. And there have been many explanations for Darwin's failure to gain acceptance in the Académie and for his cool reception in France. He appears as a transformist from the tradition of Lamarck. The Origin of Species is given an aggressive secularist translation. There's the unproven status of natural selection, the aversion to speculation, the context of spontaneous generation, and so forth. But I think two remarks by Blanchard stand out. One sees in him only an intelligent amateur, but not a savant. He lacks the true scientific spirit. An amateur is a term that recurs in debates over Darwin in French scientific circles after 1859, and we've seen in session one yesterday how the term was used within French scientific circles as well, even though amateur, the boundary between amateur, professional, savant is fluid and contested, still there's a rhetorical power to using the word in certain settings to create boundaries and margins. So within the context of the Académie, it is almost enough to call Darwin an amateur to dismiss him from consideration. And we might pass over such remarks as ignorant or elitist, but in some ways they get to the heart of the problem of Darwin's reception in France, which is the divide in disciplinary cultures, the different ways in which scientific knowledge was produced, presented, and assessed in Britain, France, and elsewhere. What's most striking, both in Quatrefages' letter and Blanchard's remarks, is that almost all of the scientific work that Darwin did after the voyage seems to count as little or nothing, or even to count against him in France. And yet all of this activity, and we might here include the 8 years he spent on a comprehensive study of barnacles, all of this had been undertaken by Darwin to gain scientific status, to establish respect as an astute observer, a cautious theorizer, a proven expert within different fields of natural history. Even the process of distributing and editing his collections was used to build a social network that brought him to the very center of London scientific society. The so-called assistants mentioned by Quatrefages were in fact the leading British experts on fossil mammals, quadrupeds, birds, and fish. So I want to look closer at this British amateur and his efforts to gain scientific credentials in Britain as a way of gauging the differences between different disciplinary cultures. So this portrait of Darwin as a young man was made after his return from the voyage, and it depicts him as a field naturalist without the accoutrements of learning. There's no books, no papers, no instruments, no study or library, only a specimen bag across his shoulders, his eyes gazing acutely outward and to the side. So this is Darwin as an observer and collector. And in later life, too, he's never shown with any props, just deep-set eyes and, of course, his signature beard. And this is in marked contrast to portraits of other scientific men in the period, even those like Thomas Huxley, who traveled extensively, or Cuvier, both young and old, who didn't travel at all. And Darwin's model is, above all, Alexander von Humboldt, the scientific traveler and author, one who combined minute observation with vivid descriptions of landscapes and bursts of generalization. In preparation for the Beagle voyage, Darwin made regular visits. Another one. I'm going to grab some water. Turn off your phones. Okay. So, in preparing for the Beagle voyage, Darwin made regular visits to the Botanical Garden in Cambridge to breathe in the tropical climate. He then returned to his rooms to absorb pages of Humboldt's personal narrative. So already in his Beagle diary, we can see him trying to write like Humboldt, moving between precise descriptions and more personal reflections, between a language of detachment and a more one more charged with emotion. And his first book, Journal of Researches, was self-consciously modeled on Humboldt's personal narrative. He negotiated with the publisher of the Beagle volumes to have his own section issued separately, and it took on a life of its own, becoming the work by which he was best known outside of the circles of British zoologists and geologists. And if you look at the title page, beside his name, you can see these letters which advertise his status as an author. The Esquire marks him as a gentleman. This very peculiar English title that carries no official rank, but distinguished a man above the common lot in manners and character rather than birth or wealth. M.A. is again peculiarly English, referring to his Cambridge degree and identifying him as a gentleman with a classical education and at least nominally Anglican. So these serve to complement the scientific credentials, FRS, Fellow of Royal Society, and Secretary to the Geological Society. They help to establish his potential as an author of general interest, not narrow specialty. And there's a tension here because Darwin himself would emphasize how his travel on the Beagle made him a naturalist. It wasn't his institutional training, it wasn't a formal degree, but it was this experience in nature, face to face, seeing animals, plants, in the complex conditions of existence across different terrains. A natural history not of the museum, not of the collection, not of a university, not of a book, but a natural history of experience. So there are two identities entwined on this page, the voyager naturalist and the gentlemanly specialist in geology, and they combine to form an expertise, an authority that is unique, perhaps, to Britain in this period, which combines elements of social class, education, experience in the field, and practical training. And all of this is quite outside the domain of professional science that's emerging elsewhere on the continent. And there are, of course, forms of disciplinary culture in Britain. There are specialist societies and journals, and Darwin participates in these. But there's almost no professional structure until much later. Though institutional posts are very few, they're poorly paid. University degrees in science are only introduced in the 1860s, and there's little or no science teaching in schools until the 1870s. But in the absence of formal scientific training and professional posts in teaching and research, authorship plays a crucial role for one wanting to pursue a scientific vocation. And there are diverse forms of science writing and contexts of reading. Victorian authors, readers, and publishers had a highly developed sense of science as a kind of literature. And many earned a living or supplemented their income through periodical writing or textbooks. The market was intensely commercial and competitive. Darwin's Journal of Researches was a literary success. It was reprinted a number of times before Origin of Species appeared. And then in 1845, he develops a new publisher with John Murray. And the voyage is republished as part of a series, The Colonial and Home Library. So Murray's firm had prospered through the poetry of Byron and the novels of Walter Scott. He was one of a number of commercial publishers who were able to market science together with a wide range of other material, English history, biography, sermons, hunting books, travel writing, cookery. And Darwin's relationship with Murray continues until the end, when Origin is published in 1859. Darwin's name appears again with a longer list of scientific credentials, but the gentlemanly Master of Arts is retained. And at the bottom, you can't see it because it's too small, but his identity as the author of a successful travel narrative is now added. So Darwin enjoys the independence from professional activity that his inherited wealth allowed him, but he did earn a substantial amount of money from his books, and he took great pains as an author, even in his most technical works, to write for a non-specialist readership. With Origin of Species, Darwin's books took on the appearance of a standard format, almost a library unto itself, in these familiar green volumes. Scientific authorship and publishing were probably more commercial in Britain than in any other country at this time, but it's important to highlight that much of this writing was not construed as popular or popularization. It was gentlemanly science. It was socially elite, yet broadly accessible. It was commercial, but not popular. And in France, this form of authorship, learned and elite, yet broad and non-specialist, seems to have a more troubled history since the early 19th century reforms of knowledge production that sought to replace the Buffonian style of natural history with a disciplinary model drawn from the mathematical and exact sciences. And outside of this, and often oriented against it, we find a large domain of science journals, magazines, encyclopedias, and dictionaries. And I'm just following the work of Pietro Corsi and Pencil Vincent on this. And my impression is that the diffusion of knowledge in cheap books and magazines, which is so widespread in Britain, and it's used by liberals and conservatives alike, this seems in France to be more critical of academic science and its control of knowledge, though there were attempts within the Académie to formalize the popularization of science as well. Darwin had a lot of difficulty finding a French publisher for Origin. None of his previous works had been translated. I won't discuss the complicated history of this translation or the controversial additions made by Clemence Royer, which have been well covered by others. Darwin finds a new French translator and publisher in 1867 through the German naturalist Karl Vogt, and Vogt warns him. He says, "France is on the whole the worst market for scientific books that one can imagine. Novels and textbooks for schools and colleges are what sell. Scientific books are the worst speculations for French booksellers." It's interesting to compare Darwin's books as they first appeared with the medical publisher Masson, and this is the usual French format for academic books, and then as they appear with his new publisher, Reinwald. This is the first work by Darwin to appear from Reinwald. It's his book on variation in 1868. And you can see how the French publisher tries to imitate the John Murray format with the hard cover, the green cloth, the gold embossing, far removed from the usual format for serious scientific books in France, as if he's trying to carve out a new genre between academic and popular press. And Reinwald writes to Darwin, "Nothing has been spared to produce a fine book which is worthy of you and of the important subject that it addresses." And Reinwald eventually takes over publication of Darwin's works in France. There's a new translation of Origin and all of Darwin's later works, and some of the earlier ones are published by Reinwald as well. Now I just want to turn to look at a different form of work, really, Darwin's habits and places of work. And here we can find even more marked differences of disciplinary culture, I think, and scientific production. So, I missed this. Oops. Okay. Seem to have missed one. Anyway, during his London years, Darwin was an active member of many learned societies. His favorite was the Athenaeum. It's a club established in the 1820s for men of literature, science, and the fine arts. And here he could enjoy the comforts of upper-class hospitality, a large library, spacious sitting and dining rooms, billiards and brandy, private baths and lodging, servants at all hours. And this was Darwin's main place of work. before he moved to Down House and established a routine of activity that he continued after moving to the country. And this is Down House here. We're all familiar with Down House, I think, in the quiet village of Kent, where he settled and worked all of his remaining life. He walks through orchid fields, he traces the paths of honeybees, he dissects pigeons, he writes his books, and he's nursed in sickness by his devoted wife. He typically spent three periods each day in the study, reading, writing, doing correspondence, microscopy, dissection, occasionally petting his dog, being sick in the screened-off corner. Intervals will pass in the drawing room, lying on the sofa, being read to. He enjoys listening to music and playing backgammon. He takes several walks a day. Sometimes he sits in the garden. All of this may look to us and to his 19th century academicians as a life of leisure, and it contrasts drastically with the working pattern of some of Darwin's contemporaries who held institutional posts. So Joseph Hooker at Kew Gardens, Huxley at the Royal School of Mines, with their 16-hour work days, their lecturing, their supervising, their examining, their committee work, their government commissions. For Darwin, however, the different rooms and spaces of his house and garden, the activities and rhythms, were all part of a regime of scientific labor. In his letters and journals, Darwin always gave the impression of being under tremendous pressure of work. He accounted for every day's output, recording the time spent on articles and books, as well as the time lost to family, to visits and illness. Interruptions and irregularities were upsetting, for the main point of all this movement about the house and about was to maximize scientific productivity. So even what might seem to be a leisure activity was actually, for Darwin, incorporated into a work regimen. And this is really the work discipline of industrial capitalism, the timekeeping, the regularity, the precise accounting for production and expenditure. And this kind of routine is usually associated with the factory system or middle-class professions. New systems of scientific observation, for example, at the Royal Observatory at Greenwich. But Darwin's regime was entirely self-imposed and curiously situated in a country house. Indeed, it positively required an expensive library, drawing room, and spacious garden. Darwin could only work himself to the bone in this manner because of his considerable wealth. And the intensity of work pervades his gentleman's study. It was not a place of polite conversation or gentlemanly display. His books are not bound in lovely leather covers. The desk is packed with scientific instruments and specimens, sometimes the remains of dissections. So from this domestic space, Darwin conducted his vast correspondence and broad reading, systematically extracting observations from a wide variety of sources, specialist monographs, scientific journals, but also garden magazines, animal breeding records, questionnaires, photographs, novels, plays, letters from poultry breeders, nurserymen, colonial officials, missionaries. Darwin the naturalist and country squire seems part of a genteel bygone age before the production of knowledge in university departments and national institutes with their factory-like laboratories, standardized training. But in Britain, where systematic science training was just becoming the norm toward the end of the century, the authority of science was rarely located in institutions or laboratories or precision instruments. For Darwin, indeed, the home was continuous with and co-productive with a variety of other disciplinary spaces, and he routinely called upon leading chemists and physiologists to run experiments in their university laboratories, often according to his design, botanical specimens flowed from the British colonies through Kew Gardens to his house. In his research on emotional expression, he recruits specialists for recording bodily movements using precision instruments in hospitals and other institutes. And his work on carnivorous plants reached from the greenhouse to chemical and physiological laboratories in Manchester and London. So with no institutional post, no botanical garden, no museum, no laboratory, working from home with his wife and children as assistants, Darwin came to possess some of the characteristics of an institution himself, occupying a stable center of authority, directing the research agendas of others, authoring a stream of publications based upon work by remote observers, collectors, and collaborators. So, in conclusion, I just want to underscore that I think it's useful to extend this category of discipline to the forms by which knowledge was communicated, the places where it was produced, the habits and practices of work. Viewed from this perspective, Darwin's discipline is that of a naturalist and an author, a kind of hybrid of scientific methods and fields, but also of forms of reading and writing and publishing. What might even seem to us in retrospect to be a kind of interdisciplinary science or a blend of science and literature was, in fact, a peculiar product of British culture, of gentlemanly learning, though it also bears some resemblance, I think, to this Buffonian style of natural history. Darwin didn't need a professorial chair to have a commanding position in British science. The only comfortable seat in his study was converted, as if for industrial use, with metal legs and wheels for ease of movement around the room. It looked like it belonged in a workshop or a factory, and it lent a sense of ruthless efficiency to the space. From here, he read his letters from Cutterfage and learned of his sorry defeat in each academy election. "Please believe that I shall do what I can to make good the good cause win," Cutterfage wrote. "But you are being strongly attacked." And during the academy debate in 1870, Blanchard's lively oration against Darwin brought a few cheers, and one of the members of the audience, believed to be Elliot de Beaumont, shouted, "C'est de la science mousseuse," a science of bubbles. And from the quiet comfort of his chair, Darwin made a geological joke. "If I had been present when Monsieur Beaumont called my science frothy, I might have rejoined that my bubbles have not as yet all burst, whilst his two great bubbles of craters of elevation and the direction of mountain chains have everywhere, except in France, burst and vanished into thin air." Thank you.